There we go. All right, good morning. You know, I got a chance to really think this week and reflect this week as I was going through this passage. And, you know, you can't read a passage like this without really reflecting upon your own life. Let me share something that I was thinking about this week in terms of reflecting over this passage. I had one question that I was enamored with when I was a kid. One question that I really pondered over and thought through as I was growing up. And the question that I asked when I was young was, why do I exist? Now, when you're between 2 and 4, you really can't ask this question because the only thing you exist for is to eat, maybe go to the washroom and take a walk. There really isn't much that you exist for, but as you get a little bit older, you start to ask this question about why exactly do you exist? Now, this question became very important because when I turned 14, I had decided that I no longer wanted to be a Christian any longer. And I made a big show and stomped around and held my breath. And finally, my parents said, you don't have to go to church anymore. And I had renounced my faith at 14. But I was stuck with this question about why do I exist now? Now that I've slipped off my faith, I've let it all go, why is it that I exist? And for a time, I enjoyed a level of freedom. And it quickly changed. Now, you know, after 14, when you ask the question, why do I exist, and the only answer that you have is, I exist to become dust, you know you have a problem. Because if there's no creator, then I came from nothing. I had no purpose, no real power, no real value, and ultimately, I was living to go to my grave. Now, you might find this is funny, but as I came to realize these things, I started to think, you know, how am I going to make my, what's my mark going to be in the world? How am I going to make it? How am I going to be remembered? And I remember, you know what, the only way that I can think of, the easiest way to be remembered is if you get published. So I spent my time, writing poetry and writing short stories, and I'm sure you guys will never find this because it's hidden in a very far corner of the internet. And I remember, like, I want to get published because I want to have some level of immortality, that when I die, that something about me will remain. And maybe I'll get famous. You never know. Well, I think we all know how this story ended, because I'm not famous. And to my knowledge today, there's no works under my name, no titles I've written, nothing I've actually published. Now, when my hopes of being published had left and were far gone, I continued to think about, you know, what it meant to exist, to become like dust. And I worked through this question more and more as I got older, and it finally got to a point when I realized what that meant, and then my life spiraled out of control. Now today, this question has a special significance for me, because when I became a Christian, these answers started to change, these questions started to change. But for many of you here, when you were in high school, maybe in university, maybe you were not as morbid as I was when I was a kid, and maybe you've never asked these questions before, but I think that these are important questions for Christians to ask. The questions about why do we exist as Christians? Why are we breathing right now? Why are we walking on this earth? For what reason has God not sent us to our heavenly home? And for those of you who are Monopoly aficionados, why is it that we have not passed go and collected our $200? This question must be answered by every Christian individually because it impacts every aspect of our lives. How do we know that we are living the right way? How do we know that we are pleasing God and not storing up his wrath? How do we know how to emotionally, socially, economically interact with the people and things around us? And how do we know that we are going to collect $200 when we pass go? Now, these are serious questions that we have to ask as Christians, that we can't escape them because they touch on the very fact of why what we're doing here today, what we're doing at our workplace, why we have friends and family. I think these are questions that are worth talking about. And I think today as we talk about and discuss Matthew chapter 5, these are things I really want you to think about. Now, just a quick kind of overview about Matthew. So the purpose of the Gospel of Matthew is discipleship. So when you're reading Matthew and you think it's an assortment of stories, you're reading it wrong. The reason why Matthew wrote this gospel is for discipleship. When you're reading it, he's teaching you how to be a disciple of Christ. And if you look at the structure and the way that it's worded, and he tries to make it very simple for us to know how we are to live, how we are to be.
And especially as we look at the Sermon on the Mount, which encompasses chapters 5 to 7 in Matthew, it's a guide for how to live as disciples in this world. In chapter 5, it begins with 8 Beatitudes. And these are the values of the kingdom of heaven. It should remind us of the distinctiveness that we should have from the world. It commends those who are living these Christian values, these kingdom values, and reminds us to not judge our successes based on the ridicule that we receive, but by the word of God. Now, as you arrive to verse 11 and 12, you notice here that I didn't really include that as part of the Beatitudes. And I'm including it here as part of verses 13 and 16. And I'm doing this for a particular reason, because I think that verses 11 to 12 better prepare us for the following passages than it should be linked to the Beatitudes. And I have two reasons why. Number one is that the ninth Beatitude in verses 11 and 12 are in fact repetitions and expansions of verse 10. And it doesn't quite fit the tight structure of the other eight Beatitudes here. The second reason for this is because as you look at verses 1 through 10, you'll notice that it begins with things like blessed are thee or blessed are those. But starting from verse 11 and 12, it says blessed are you, right? You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. And so I think this part, this section fits better together from verses 11 to 16 than just 13 to 16. So that's why we're going to be talking about verses 11 to 12 today. Now, in verse 11, Jesus says this, blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. We need to talk about why this world needs to be influenced. As we look at John chapter 1, you know, John tells us that Jesus comes into this world because it is a dark place, that it is in darkness, and people are in dark because they have been blinded by Satan and they love their sin. People think that they're the ones who are the best to decide what is right and wrong in their own lives, and their own personal morality is what should guide them. They take the place of God in this sense. And that we should live to honor ourselves as we live this life. Right? If there's really nothing else to live for, then we should live to ourselves. They live as if God did not exist, and that he's not king in this world, and they enjoy this world's pleasures and see any twist in their living as harmless. Now, why it's important for us to talk about why the world needs to be influenced today is because in chapters 5, when we talk about kingdom values, we're talking about that we have a calling to influence this world. In fact, as we look at verses 11 to 16, it's all about influence. Who is influencing who? And 11 and 12 is talking about how will the world influence you as a believer? How do they do this? What methodology do they use to do that? Now, the reason why we're going to experience difficulty in this world is because God's values assault the darkness that's in this world. Think about that for a second, right? In the first part, it talks about persecution and reviling, and you're asking why, right? Like, look at the way that I'm living. It's like, isn't this good? Like, why is it that people are angry at me or upset at me? And the reason for this, as I said before, is because God's values assault the darkness of this world. The best example of this, I think, is when we share the gospel, when we live out the gospel, because we're asking people to grapple with the darkness in their own lives. Think about the first point that we make about the gospel, right? That we should tell people that they have sinned and that their sins are deserving of death. What you're really telling people is that they've lived their life entirely wrong this entire time. And that everything that they have done up to this point is deserving of death. And anything previously they've enjoyed in the dark, you know, was not harmless, but was actually fatal. Think of the second point that we tell people, right? We tell people that, again, their sin deserves death. What we're telling them is that we're exposing their earthliness. We're exposing their sinfulness. And we're telling them how evil they really are. Think about the last point we tell people. We tell people that they need to believe upon the Lord Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. I just want you to think about the meaning of what this is to people and how in some ways it can be seen as very offensive to some people. Right? It says that people can't depend on themselves to make things right, that they have to rely on God to be able to make things right, that really they are so bad that God himself had to die for their sins, and that the ultimate authority of right and wrong in their life doesn't lie in them, but lies in God the Father. We're basically telling people that everything that you've been doing has been wrong, that you need somebody else to help you, that you can't rely on yourself, right? Very countercultural to the rest of the world. And in this way, it is very offensive to a lot of people. And if our message wasn't so necessary, it'd be downright insulting. And for this reason, people will revile you, they will say things that are false about you, they will persecute you for sharing the gospel, to living the gospel life, because it is offensive to their being to hear these things, to know these things. And this persecution, this reviling will take on many forms. Right, I probably don't need to share this with many of you today, because many of you have probably tried to have lived this Christian life, you've had non-Christian friends, and you try to share the gospel with them, you try to live a life that is pleasing to God, and the way that people respond sometimes blows you away. You might lose friendships or be socially excluded from people that you've known for a very long time. You may be the object of gossip among people you know. You may be harmed physically. And you may experience economic and societal and other hardships. And yet, as we look at this passage, verse 11, how does it tell us that we should handle this reviling and persecution? Right, verse 11, it says blessed, right? Another word for this is happy. Happy are those when others revile you and persecute you. Right, in the next passage, in verse 12, it says rejoice and be glad. Right, when's the last time that when somebody persecuted you that you laughed it off or you smiled or you made a joke or you said, can I please have another? Not often. And yet, it's funny that one of the funniest stories that I've ever seen is in Acts chapter 5, that after the apostles are, they're basically teaching, and they're teaching in the synagogues, and the Pharisees see them, and they get angry, and they jail them, and then they escape, and then they go back and teach again. And then you think they would learn the lesson, but they go back and teach, and then they take them again, and then they punish them. They basically, you know, hit them with rods to tell them, hey, don't teach anymore, don't keep doing that. And they basically rejoice over knowing that they've suffered for the faith. You know, when's the last time that you've ever done that? When's the last time you've ever seen that? This is one of the most comical stories for me in the entire New Testament, because it's so countercultural, so different than what we experience, that it really shows a side, a humorous, enlightening side of how our faith should look like. Now, you may ask, you know, how can we be happy when we're reviled? How can we be happy when we're persecuted? How can people even talk about rejoicing? How do we handle this kind of suffering? I have 4 points here, I think, when we talk about suffering or reviling that I think may help us in terms of understanding how do we rejoice? How are we happy when these things happen? So firstly is that we know that it is part of God's plan and that we are going to suffer for glory. And we find this in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 10. So part of the fact is that we know that suffering is not incidental to the Christian life, that it is a part of the plan of how God uses persecution to build us up, that these are actually things that are used to help us, right? Even though it may not seem so at the time, right? So knowing that it's part of the plan, it helps us to rejoice, helps us to be happy when these things happen. Number two is that suffering helps us to develop a faith that is more tangible and full of character, as we can see in Romans chapter 5, verses 3 to 5. I want you to think about when people go through suffering. There are two effects when people go through suffering. So firstly, when people go through suffering, they could just fall apart. They may just let go of their faith. They may not be able to deal with it. They may have to hide in a corner for a little bit to breathe. Your faith can just be shattered and can just be completely destroyed. But I think the way that as we look at suffering and persecution, it also helps us to grow. Helps us to build character. helps us to learn how to be more like Christ. So some of the reasons why we should be happy, we should rejoice, is that through suffering, we are learning to be more like Christ. And what more can we ask? We're asking this every single day, right? When we read our scriptures, when we pray, we're asking to be more like Christ. And now God is making this tangible. He is making a way for this to happen. So we should rejoice and be happy when this happens. Thirdly, we can be happy and rejoice when we suffer because we know that our reward is much greater than the suffering we endured. So I want you to remember every pain. I want you to think about every difficulty you've experienced because that you have stood firm in your faith and people have ridiculed you, that you've been persecuted, and to know that there is something that is waiting for you that is greater than that, that it will make what you experience so small that we can, that basically one day we will look back at this and we will laugh because of the glory that will be revealed. My last point here is that if you are suffering, if you are being persecuted and you're reviling, specifically because of your faith, not because of something else, like you're being silly or something, be ready for some of the sweetest fellowship with God that you've ever experienced in your life. Let me tell you a story here. I don't like to tell this story because I feel like it was a major changing point in my life, and there's still parts of it that I'm still working out, and I'm still working out if I was right or wrong, and this has been more than 10 years ago that I've been working at this story. But let me tell you the story. So when I was a Christian early on, one of the people that really brought me to the faith was a girl. And, you know, we were very good friends, and we had a very personal relationship, and she was my best friend. And at the time, she started dating a non-Christian, and you know, at first I thought, you know, what's the big deal with that? And one of her friends approached me, we talked it out, I realized that dating non-Christians is actually something that we should be really worried about for ourselves especially, but especially for people that are our friends. And I called her out on it. I told her, like, this is how I feel, this is what's happening. And this is somebody's baptism that I witnessed, and I told them that you know, we had witnessed your baptism, and therefore we have a responsibility to call you out, to tell you how you're living is wrong. Now, this all culminated in one day, and we were online, and at the time, the big thing was MSN or ICQ. Now, people who are under, 12? Like, you guys may not even know what these things are. Let me assure you that this is the way that we never use Facebook. The way that you would message each other is by these instant messaging things. It's kind of like Skype before Skype was ever a thing. And on ICQ, she messaged me and she said, "Tell me exactly how you feel." Now, I was born very blunt, so, you know, I thought this is great. Right? She wants me to tell her how she feels. Amazing. I'm just going to tell her everything. I'm going to lay it all out. Again, I'm going to try to prepare in such a way that it's going to be loving, but I'm going to tell her exactly how I feel. She's giving me a chance. And boy, was I wrong. So for the next 5 minutes, I laid out this paragraph by paragraph statement about all the things that I thought she was doing wrong, about how I felt that she had made a disaster of her faith. And then basically I felt great because I just unleashed everything that I've been holding back in this one ICQ message. And then afterwards she logged offline and I didn't see her for 2 weeks. Shortly afterwards, just before that, we had shared about maybe 80% of our friends in common. So 4 out of 5 of my friends we had known in common. And shortly after this, after I had said all these things to her, she told all of our friends. Somehow, in the course of a couple of days, everybody, all of our friends in common knew. And none of them were Christians. And so for them, it's like, well, what, you know, this guy's a nice guy. Like, how can you tell her not to date this person? And slowly but surely, all my friends drifted away. This is probably some of the loneliest times that I've ever had in my life, that without, you know, really getting to be around people, to really talking to people, because none of them wanted to talk to me because of what I had done to her. And for the first couple of weeks, I really thought through this question about, you know, was it really worth it? You know, losing all of these people, all of these friends over what, you know, over this, is it really worth it? You know, I prayed the hardest I've ever prayed during that time, and I remember this time so clearly because it was just God. As I was reading through the scriptures, I could experience who God was and taste who He was and me. It was just God and me. This was over the course of maybe 4 months, and it was just God and me. You know, looking back at what had happened, I saw the necessity of suffering during this time. And I felt like I was learning 1,000 lessons a day about the character of God and theology proper. You know, it's one thing for you to be taught theology, but it's another thing to experience and to feel it, even before you learn it. I remember making significant changes to my character because as I looked at the revelation of who God was, I couldn't help but change because I could see how glorious and wonderful He was and how loving He was, and I just wanted to be like that. Part of these changes is that I started to make this rule book that I've told a couple people about, and I've kind of hesitated to tell people this story because there's the part where I've created this rule book. Now, I need to preface this a little bit because I created a rule book specifically with how to interact with women. So it basically consisted of like a book of rules of, you know, when you're talking with women, these are things that you should do or not do. Now, I need to be very clear here that I no longer have this book today. It doesn't exist any longer, number one. All right, so if you're looking at me and it looks like I'm thinking about something, I'm not thinking about my rules, all right? So don't think about that. But number two is I realized that these rules aren't just about women. I actually experienced a lot of these things with Christians, both men and women, together. So I think these rules are both applicable. And my first two rules came from what had happened with my story with this person that I had known who I had lost as a friend. So my first rule is this, is that you should never, if someone is angry at you and she's angry over email or through ICQ, which I guess I should scrub off now, you should never solve or try to resolve your problems over email. Now, you might think that's an easy thing, but I had no idea that this is a thing. So when it happened, I think that's rule number one. Rule number two was, specifically if a woman is angry at you and she tells you to tell her the truth, it's a trap. All right? It's a trap. Now, to be fair today, I don't believe that it's just a trap with women. It's a trap with men, too, because men do that, too. But it's a trap. Now, these are just small things I talked about that have changed, but there's some significant things in my own life that changed my own life. I just felt like a desire to want a fellowship. I felt like there was a desire to want to care about people. And, you know, I learned so much about how to love and how to care and about fellowship that as I think about some of the relationships that I have with you guys today, the reason why I value them so much is because of this time here. You learn the most about valuing things that are important to you when you lose them all. I also learned that God's promises are the most powerful during times of difficulty. And I keep continuing to realize how amazing those promises actually are. Because at the time, I was thinking, you know, what's this going to look like now? Like, am I just going to be alone? Like, am I going to go buy a shack out in the boonies and live there my entire life? Is this the life that's going to happen to me? And what sustained me during this time was just remembering God's character and God's promises. And I reflected on these things every single day. And even at times in my own life after that, that caused such disruptions in my own life, things that where I felt betrayed or where I didn't understand where things were going to go, I could always trust, because I remember back to this time, that God was sovereign over all these things. Very last point. I have never loved the Lord more or felt more loved by God than during that time. It was the sweetest time of fellowship in my life, and I continually yearn to get back there. You know, it's funny that we often cry out in pain during our suffering and difficulty. It's often interesting, in fact, that the time that I want the most from God is the time that was the worst, probably the most difficult time in my life. But I remember so clearly God was so imminently there, that God was answering prayers, that He was always giving me hope and joy and peace, and just knowing that things were going to be okay. And even when I felt that I had nobody, I felt that I had God. Now, I'm not perfect in suffering. I'm far from it, in fact. I think my wife will attest to that. I know I don't have all the answers when people suffer. And many of you have suffered in ways that, for your faith, that I can't even begin to imagine. But I think I can tell you this, and I'm sure other Christians could tell you this, and I have 2 points here, that my suffering has increased my faith in God and His promises. And number 2, that my suffering has made me look forward to the glory that God will reveal at judgment, that I am promised, and that one day, that any suffering that I've experienced, is that He will more than compensate for. Now, we talked about, why we need to influence the world. We talked about how will the world try to influence you. And the main way, like I said again, they're going to try to revile you and persecute you because the message that you give is so counter-world that they don't want to hear it. Now, the question becomes, how do we impact or how do we influence the world around us? And in the passage now, it's going to give us 2 ways. Number 1 is that you are the salt of the earth. There's a question in evangelicalism today about how much should we be like our culture? You know, how close should we be? Because we can't be so far off as to not be able to really relate with anybody. But at the same time, we have to be very careful about how exactly we look like our culture. Now, you think about the scale, right? Like, so beginning with the way that we worship, should we be hymns only? Should we be... So I just saw Yiwei, he just nodded his head. But should we be hymns only? Should we use instruments? Should our preaching, look more like classically like the church has been? Or should we open it up for more discussion? Now, there's this sliding scale of how much should we look like our culture today? And I think this question needs to be grounded in this answer that we are to be the salt of the earth. Now, the exact meaning of what it means to be salt is not quite clear, but I do have 3 points here that I think that the original hearers listening to this would have understood. So firstly is that we as the church exist to give this world a taste of the heavenly reality. In the ancient world, salt, and much like you do today, that you would use salt to flavor your food, right? I think most of us do. And in the same way that we are to be salt to the people around us, that we are to flavor the relationships, the people around us, and giving them a taste of the heavenly reality. We are called to live and speak in such a distinctly Christian way that it should remind people of what should be. Point number 2, we as a church exist to preserve this world from the effects of corruption. Now, the second way, in terms of the ancient world, how they perceive salt, and maybe this is something you guys don't do often today, is that they use salt to preserve their food. So they would salt their food so it would last longer. I don't think any of us do that today because we have refrigerators, but this is one way in which people would preserve food, and that's one way they would understand this passage. And so for us today, we should see ourselves as preserving our culture. Now, I find this is a very difficult one for us today, right? Because when people do crazy things, how do you preserve them from doing crazy things? Right, if somebody has their mindset to jump the cliff, you could keep telling them not to jump, but if their mind is set on it, they're going to do it. And yet, for us, we have a calling to preserve this culture as best as we can. We are called to live and speak in such a distinctively Christian way as to preserve the world from inherent evil in our society. How important is that for you today? When your culture goes wrong, when your workplace goes wrong, when your classrooms go crazy, who among us, have stood up and made a case for why they believe the Christian way is the better way? And these topics are important. They aren't just a matter of personal holiness. They are a matter of worldly holiness. They're a matter of really seeing God's kingdom values recognized or realized on this earth today as well. Questions such as like abortion and gender and marriage. We have to engage in these questions. And it's not just one of us needs to engage, because if only Dr. Dave here is the only one engaging, you know, how many people is an academic really going to reach, realistically, right? Academics might reach 100 people, maybe. And then how many people here actually read academics? Very few, I would assume, right? So here's my question. If they don't see things being preserved, if they don't see a taste of the reality of heaven, what are they going to do? Who's going to show that to them? Lastly, number three, we as a church are essential for the well-being of the world. Now, in some Jewish writings here, the salt is portrayed as something that is essential to the world. Let me ask you this question. Do you see the church's role as essential to this world? How essential do you think it is? And do you see yourself as a part of this church as essential to this world? You know, we talk a lot about church, and we talk a lot about that people should be going, but we need to spend more time in recognizing that God has a purpose for his people, his visible body on this world, to be salt, to flavor people, to preserve them. And if the church does not do it, there's nobody else out there who will do it. For the church to exist as salt, we are called to remain distinctive in this world, and we can never assimilate. We talked about this idea that to salt, that we need to preserve and that we need to flavor, and we can never lose that. We can never assimilate into our cultures perfectly because we can never lose the flavor, we can never lose the preservative. I want you to imagine for a second if some by some random chance all the computers in the world were destroyed or had disappeared. We would think that this is a game changer to the world. This is essential to the world. And that by losing them, huge things would change. Do you think the same way about the church? Because God's redemptive history revolves around not computers, but around the church. And what role do you play? What role do we play as a church in doing that, in recognizing that, in fulfilling this idea that we are to be salt? And if we become, and if there is no church, what light is there to offer? I just want you to think about a couple questions here. Among your peers and friends, are you giving the people around you a taste of Christ? Do your friends know what Christ tastes like? Does it taste like chicken? Does it taste like steak? What does it taste like? Secondly, among your peers and friends, are you preserving them from evil? Thirdly, are you a part of a visible body, perhaps this church body, bringing taste and preservation to the world? We ask this question about why do you exist? And here Christ tells us one major reason why we exist is to be salt on this earth. Point number two, there's a warning for those who are called themselves believers and are tasteless. Verse 13 and 14 here. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall it be made saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown and trampled under people's feet. What Jesus has in mind here are Christians who have lost their distinctiveness in this world and who have assimilated into it and no longer offer any flavor. And if you offer no flavor, what do you contribute to this society? If you've lost your flavor, what value is there in becoming a Christian in this world? Christ here compares those people who have lost the flavor of the salt or being unsalty to those who have either never been Christians at all or those who just don't care. But if you don't care, or you really weren't salt to begin with, you have nothing to really offer this society. and the scriptures, and this passage here seems to have the view that if you're not salty, then really you're foolish. And therefore, any of us who assimilate into our culture after we have known the tastefulness, the flavor of Christ, we are foolish for doing so. There's a warning here for us as believers to preserve your saltiness. Let's move on here. Verse 14, you're the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden, and a city on a hill... Now, I want to make very clear here that as we talk about the idea that when we talk about you are the salt of the earth, you are the light of the world, this doesn't just mean individually. It means as a church, we are to be salt. And as a church, we are to be light. Now, what does it mean for believers to be light? We are light when we share the gospel. John chapter 1, it says Jesus is called to be light. And just like John the Baptist, our purpose is like his, where in verse 6 it says, there was a man who was sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to bear witness about the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. In the same way, for us to be light of this world, we are called to bear witness about Jesus Christ. That is one way in which we are light. The second way in which we are light here is that our light, we are light when our actions illuminate the glory of God. As we looked at the Beatitudes, as Thomas read for us this morning, right, when we live in opposed to how the world lives, where most people will be sorrowful, we will rejoice. Where most people are worried, we will be happy. This also speaks towards the way in which our lives line up with the gospel. When our lives line up to the gospel, this is revealing the glory of God. And lastly, when people see our distinctiveness and the way that we try to glorify God and they rejoice in heaven, this also brings light. In the second part of this passage here, in verse 15, we are also called to display this light proudly and visibly. You know, how open are we as a church to display our light? As you think about this question about being light, have you been trying to hide your faith from your friends? Basically, you just don't want them to know that you're a Christian. Because that is the opposite of what Jesus has in mind here. With your peers and friends, are you open with your faith? Do they know what it means for you to be a Christian? Do your actions display the glory of God? Are you being salt and light? Let's read verses 15 to 16 very quickly here. Nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Has your light diminished in fear of reviling or persecution? You know, I've had some very tough times in my Christian life, and I've received a lot of negative criticism from both Christians and non-Christians alike. So from believers, I felt that sometimes that my heart is in the right place, but sometimes the words that I use don't come out the way that I want them to sound. And often people mistake my love for judgment and mistake my enthusiasm for pride. And because of these things, it's frustrating and it's angering, and you just want to let your love go cold, because most people think that you're more loving when you actually ask them less about their Christian life. And as I started to ponder about these things, my mind and my heart just couldn't take it any longer. With your non-Christian friends, maybe you've been scorned. Maybe you've lost friends. Maybe they gossip about you. Maybe they make fun of you. And maybe because of these things, you're at the end of your emotional rope. And so you want to stop sharing the gospel and caring for other people. If you have identified with either of these two camps today, I can relate with you. And let me share with you that I found Paul's words uplifting here in Galatians chapter 6, verse 9. Let us not become weary in doing good, for at the proper time we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. So for people here who are struggling with any of these two camps, do not give up. I say it again, do not give up. And doing good out of fear and reviling is still good because it pleases God. Number two, do not judge your successes by people's ridicule, but by God's word. Be reminded that God, who sees the heart, has an unimaginable glory awaiting us that will make what we are going through right now more worth it. Just be patient. Therefore, do not give up. Do not change. Do not bend. You are on the right path. If I could give you two pieces of advice here for people who have gone through these things and whose hearts are at the fray and they're ready to unravel, let me encourage you to pray hard, with tears and with loud words. You know, it's very helpful when you pray and you scream out your prayers, believe it or not. If you never tried it before, I insist that you try it at least once in your life. Secondly, pray for people as much as possible and as long as possible, and the feeling of love will quickly be restored. If you have identified with these two things where you have felt that you've been scorned or reviled and persecuted, and because of these things you want to hide your light, I encourage you, do not give up. Persist. Fight. Do not bend. And if you feel that way, pray. Pray hard. So quickly here, this last thing about light I want to talk about is, whose light are you radiating, if any at all? You know, when you go to a Chinese restaurant with your family and it comes time to pay the bill, some of the best acting in the world goes on there. Let me give you an example. When it's time to pay the bill, my grandparents try to grab the bill first. My mother makes a huge, gratuitous point about who she is and how wonderful she is, and she should save her money, and then tries to take the bill. And then my other relatives try to do the same thing. Now, this is some of the greatest acting you'll ever see in the world for this reason. Number one is that you already know who's going to pay the bill already. Right? My grandmother's going to pay the bill, no matter what. Right? So we already know how this story ends. All the rest is just acting. Secondly is that we know that people actually love money, and if they could, they wouldn't want to pay. That paying for this is just more of a courtesy, is more of a sign of face. And number two, the last point, is that people do this to gratify each other. Here's my question for you today. Is your Christian faith like that? That you're the person who wants to pay the bill? This passage reminds us that the motions of good deeds are not what matters, but rather that we are doing things to glorify God. This is the difference between a Pharisee or legalist and a true believer. It is in the heart, the reason why you want to do these things. Psalm chapter 18, verse 28, For it is you who light my lamp, the Lord my God lightens my darkness. Now, not only is the question, whose light do you illuminate, but do you emit light at all? We must always test our hearts about this, because there is no light in ourselves, and it is only the light when it illuminates the one who provides the light. So for us believers today, this light that is in you, let it shine. Like the song goes, right? This little light of yours, let it shine. Let it shine brightly for all to see, that you may see the wonder and glory, so they may see the wonder and glory of your Savior. Let me conclude here, because I think I've run past my time here. At the introduction, I talked about what my life was like in high school, and it's funny because when I was living this life, I used to live down the street from here. Right by the clock tower, right by where the fire station is, I lived right there. And I lived there for about 10 years. And the one thing that I've been thinking about when I came to CGC 7 to 8 years ago is, if what if someone from this church 15 years ago had been salt and light to me then, and I had not had to wait until I had left downtown and moved up there. Now, I am not attacking the church in any way. I'm not attacking anyone individually here. But what if somebody, one of us, had gone, and if there's somebody else out there that had gone at that point in time and had been salt and light in my life then? I wonder if I would have had to go through the difficult teenage years without a purpose. I wonder if I would have had a better sense of reality at that time, that I wouldn't have had to go through all that emotional and spiritual turmoil and tasted something better than I had then. What if someone took a chance and risked their pride and their emotional well-being for the sake of Christ, for the sake of Zion, for the sake of fallen souls? Do you know why being salt and light matters? It's because souls matter. And how will people hear and see the living gospel if they don't know what to believe? And how can people believe what they have never heard? And how will they believe without someone bringing the gospel to them? Christians cannot simply assimilate into this culture because we have something too precious to lose. And we can't turtle into our own Christian bubbles because what we have is too precious to keep to ourselves. We are called to be bold with our faith and to light a fallen world. And this is how we are called to live, what is pleasing to God, how we relate to the people and things around us. This is why we haven't passed go yet. This is why we still have work to do before we collect. Blessed and happy are those that bring good news. Thank you.